Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the 2023 convention program of the California Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss. I'm Frank Welty, president of CAAVL, and I welcome you all here this evening for a great and informative program put on by our excellent program committee. And I want to remind everyone that we will be having our business meeting at the same time on Saturday, April 15th, and I hope that you will all be in attendance for that as well. Without further ado, I will turn the microphone over to Jeff Tom, who will be moderating this first hour of our program this evening.
Okay, thank you, Frank. So I am going to be your moderator, and I'm going to do as little moderating as I can. But I do want to give you a little introduction before I bring on our speakers, because I think it's important to know why our first hour is going to deal with some of the issues faced by residents of, and specifically residents of vision loss of skilled nursing facilities. Skilled nursing facilities are really the highest form of residential care. They're, step below hospitals, but they're for people who more often than not do not leave, but sometimes are able to be reintegrated into the community, and that's really a goal more and more now. This is an area that the California Council of the Blind has, I must say, unfortunately, not really focused on
Meeting
in a
information.
long time, if ever really. But now we are, and we are working hard this year. We have a bill, Assembly Bill 488, where we wish to target some money that has already been begun to be appropriated by the legislature, so we don't have to put new money in the budget for staff training and accompanying, program improvements for skilled nursing facilities. We want to target some of this money for people with vision loss. We are facing some pushback already with those who would prefer to not share in this big pot of money in the facilities themselves, but we're going to work with that, and we're going to persevere and hopefully find a way to enable staff to be trained in the needs of our population and to have improvements in the way facilities assist their residents who are blind or who have low vision. So we're going to be calling on you as the season goes on. Our first hearing is coming up in about a month. So we will be calling on you soon to help us advocate for that. This is especially, of course, an issue that CAAVL should be involved in, as most residents are seniors. And with that, I'm going to introduce our two speakers. The first one, I'm sure, is known to many of you. She has been at ACB conventions. She has been on community calls of various stripes, including disabilities calls and others. She has been in the field for decades and is really one of the most, one of the persons who has the greatest degree of expertise in terms of acknowledged that I am aware of anyway, Nancy V.B. Miller. Nancy runs is the CEO of Visions, which is a adult daycare center that provides services to people with vision loss, seniors with vision loss, and really all seniors in New York City. But although Nancy herself is not blind, most of her staff is blind or has low vision. And I think they model what they do for all of the clients who are not. And Nancy is an incredible individual and someone that I respect immensely. And without further ado, let me introduce the other speaker first, and then I'll turn it over to Nancy. Our second speaker is someone from an agency that is perhaps the most well thought of agency in this country in terms of people who are aging. They are based in California and now as well in Washington, D.C. We have had their executive director, Kevin Prendeville, at one of our conventions back in the pre-COVID days. So our speaker today, along with Nancy, will be Gulela Selassie, and I hope I haven't butchered your name, who is a senior attorney at Justice and Aging. So we're going to start with Nancy. Nancy, take it away.
Jeff, thank you so much. I am based in the New York City metropolitan area, and I want to give you a little bit more about my background. I actually worked in a nursing home back in the 1980s, the middle 1980s, as a discharge social worker. So I was the person who helped people who came into the nursing home to get out of the nursing home. That was my goal. And we did a research project to determine what were some of the factors that enabled people to actually leave. The number one factor was that they had a home to go back to. So back in those days, Medicaid, which was the New York service that most health insurance, that most nursing home residents were using, they had a 90-day requirement. They would only allow your rent to be paid for 90 days. And if you didn't leave the nursing home by 90 days, you would lose your apartment. So that became the mantra of myself and the other social workers, that we work very closely with the rehabilitation department, with the doctors and nurses in the nursing home, to have a plan that the person would be able to leave, even if it was the 89th day, but it enabled them to have a home to go home to. And the second factor was a support system. Now, that support system didn't necessarily have to be family, but it needed to be neighbors, friends, acquaintances who would help that person reintegrate back into the community. So I've seen the positives and negatives of nursing home services, both from the inside and the outside. A few years ago, Visions, which actually serves all ages from birth to death, but we've specialized in working with the older population, since more than half of the people that we serve identify as somebody who is over the age of 60. And that's of all racial and ethnic groups, coming from all different backgrounds, but we work with people who are primarily low income. Well, a couple of years ago, the very issue that ACB in California is looking at came to our attention when a skilled nursing facility came to us and said they were going to be creating one floor in the nursing home specifically for people with vision loss. And they hired us as a consultant to create the environment that would make it the most possible for people to stay independent. And they wanted this to be their calling card for people who needed nursing home care, but also were visually impaired or blind. And what they set up was a floor that had signage that was large and very high contrast. They had tactile markings on the walls. The rooms were carpeted, the hallways and the dining hall and the recreation area was not. So people could just feel underfoot very easily, whether they had entered a bedroom or whether they were in a common area. They did not have guide rails, and we did not recommend guide rails unless people needed them for support. They were not needed by people just because they were visually impaired. And we also made a very strong effort to train the nurses' aides and the aides that just because somebody was blind, they should not be placed in a wheelchair. And we did all the training that they needed to help people have the greatest level of mobility, to help people be as independent as possible. We helped them set up the dining room so that people could either serve themselves if they wanted, or they could have the meal served to them. But it was done in a way that took advantage of whatever residual vision they had. So the placemats color contrasted with the plates, and the silverware was a different color than the plates, so that people would find it easier to feed themselves without having to be dependent on someone else. We also taught the aides not to do too much for people who are blind just because they were blind. If somebody had a physical disability, if they had a tremor, if they had a grip problem, then we would work collaboratively with the occupational therapist. But otherwise, the idea was blind people are often made more dependent than they need to be because of the fear, the risk that sighted people feel that blind people will create. And I think this was a very successful model, but it took the administration of that skilled nursing facility to reach out to us, and they actually got it paid for through a private foundation, not through government. Government was not willing at that time to pay for the adaptations, the computers that had JAWS and Zoom text, and paying for a computer trainer who actually knew how to use the software. It didn't pay for the special plates and cutlery, special signage. So they used private foundation funds to be able to fund that. Go forward a couple of years, and we were doing a special project reaching out to the older population in Staten Island, which is a borough, a county of New York City. And a foundation in Staten Island approached us and said, we have nursing homes in Staten Island that we feel need training on how to work with somebody who is blind. Now, the reason that's so critical is in New York, the New York State Commission for the Blind, which is the primary funder of training of people who are blind, will not pay for services if an older person is residing in a nursing home. So there really is no government funding source specifically for blind or visually impaired people who live in nursing homes, whether they're there long-term or whether they're there short-term. The policy basically says that the nursing home is getting paid a certain daily rate, and that rate should cover all of the needs of the residents that live in that nursing home. And nothing extra is given if a large percentage of the nursing homes have people who are blind or visually impaired. What we discovered in that special project, about 60% of the older people who were living in the skilled nursing facility had diminished vision. Now, in some cases, it was because they had not had a recent eye exam, and the glasses that they had were no longer appropriate for the prescription that they needed. And the nursing home was not regularly testing their vision. So some of the work we did was just basically refraction, helping people with diminished vision to get the best refraction so that they could see as well as they could with prescription glasses. Then we added additional magnification and optical aids for those people who were legally blind. We were able to get them low vision examinations with a low vision optometrist who specialized in working with people with severe vision loss with any amount of residual vision. And mostly what he did, besides magnification, was work with lighting, task lighting, making sure that people knew what kind of lamp or what kind of overhead light they could use that would minimize the glare. Everything that we do at Visions for older people living at home, we try to translate those services into the nursing home environment. It worked extremely well. But again, the nursing home administration was open to having experts from the vision field come in and create an environment that encouraged more independence and encouraged people to use whatever residual vision they had. We were really surprised that the number of people who identified as visually impaired was so high. But in almost every case, they had some other chronic health condition that brought them into the nursing home. It was not their blindness or vision impairment. It was incontinence. It was early or mid-stage dementia. It was physical frailty, balance problems, and a history of falls that had to do more with muscular and neurological issues than it had to do with vision loss. So it was a pretty typical skilled nursing facility population, and yet the vision loss was not being addressed or treated appropriately. I've now become very involved, and Jeff Tom is, and a number of ACB people are involved with the National Aging and Vision Loss Coalition, which is sponsored by the Vision Serve Alliance, which is a coalition of all of the organizations, schools, and foundations that are doing work in the vision field. So we have schools, dog guide schools, ACB, every provider agency. And the CEOs of these organizations share information, learn together to try to get more services to people with vision loss. What we know from the National Eye Institute is less than 5% of people who could benefit from basic vision rehabilitation services, a low vision exam, low vision devices, vision rehabilitation therapy, and orientation and mobility along with counseling, less than 5% of the population that could benefit ever receives that service. Now, we're lucky in New York, in California, in Texas, in Florida, there's a more robust service system. And so we are probably serving more than 5%. But if you go to many states, they don't have a single vision rehab therapist, or if they have an orientation and mobility specialist, they work only in the VA hospitals or with children. So the dearth and shortage of specialized vision professionals, especially outside of the coast, East Coast and West Coast, means that many older blind people and many people with vision loss, but residual vision, never get the services that they need. And the nursing home population is particularly unserved or underserved. We know that advocacy works. It works with both funding and it works with changing policy so that people who are in greatest need will be able to get the services that they should and that they're actually entitled to. What the Vision Serve Alliance has done is created a demographic picture for every state of the older population that identifies as blind or having severe vision loss. And this is a question that comes from the American Community Survey of the US Census. And they took all of those answers and then they looked at the demographics of each state. And it's amazing the differences in the prevalence rate of older people with vision loss, not only from state to state, but within states. So for example, in New York State, the prevalence rate from one county to another is 3% versus 15% of the older population that identifies as blind. The 3% is in a county that is primarily white, wealthy, well-educated, and has access to good health care. The 15% is in the counties that have Latino Hispanic populations, the oldest old, less access to health care, the less educated, and older people who are more likely to be living in poverty. We also found the highest prevalence rate in rural areas. So the demographics of each state are really important. That demographic exists for California. If you don't have it already, you can access it. California participated in our big data project. And the national statistics are also available. So you can compare what the demographics and prevalence rate is in California compared to the national rate. Now, that particular data excludes people in nursing homes. So it's only going to give you data of elders who are living in the community. That could be in assisted living, it could be in a continuing care community, it could be in their own home, but it is not people who live in skilled nursing facilities. There is some data on the skilled nursing facility population that is done pretty regularly, and it does confirm that many older people who are living in nursing homes are also living with visual impairment. So, you know, how do we make a difference? Obviously, if we can get legislation that mandates spending money on vision services in nursing homes is a terrific priority. That's, you know, where you have a mandate that comes with funding, it doesn't get better than that. But at least to make government officials aware of the high prevalence rate of vision loss in the elder population, and particularly in subgroups that are much more likely to experience vision loss, either because of heredity, culture, lack of finance, living in poverty, lower education, or lack of access to timely and appropriate health care. The other issue that comes up in looking at the older population and those that are living in nursing homes has to do with the immigrant population. And those people who have immigrated to the United States and have become citizens or have green cards, have access to services. Those people who have come who are undocumented often are the most unserved. And I can tell you in New York State, even just in New York City, Visions is the only vision rehab agency that will serve people who are undocumented because there's no government funding source to fund that service. So even though we have three very large vision rehabilitation agencies serving New York City, only one of us actually serves the undocumented population. So we have a lot of work to do, but we know how to solve the problem. We just need allies who will help us get government to write the policies that will enable us to serve the people in need, even with starting with eye exams to make sure that people have the proper prescription. And then if people are still legally blind, even with the appropriate prescriptions, getting them the low vision exam and low vision optical aids that will enable them to be as independent as possible. So I'm going to stop there. I don't know if we have time for questions now or at the end, but I applaud California and the legislation you're trying to pass. I think it's exactly the right direction to go in. And you have many allies in other states that will be following your progress and see if we can duplicate it, replicate it in our own states. So thank you, Jeff, and thank you, ACB.
Currently, we do not have any hands.
So thank you, Nancy, for those very informative remarks. Just one comment before I turn it over to Galela for her comments on the skilled nursing facility landscape. As most of you know, and as Nancy pointed out, we do have a robust set of private agencies here in California. And believe me, they are very eager to see this bill pass and to have an opportunity to be funded to go out to skilled nursing facilities and provide exactly the type of training that Visions has been providing. And so I think it will be very easy to implement this type of bill if we are able to get it passed. So that's going to be where all of you come in. With that,
can you make a comment before we go on?
Sure.
My dad spent the last 2 years of his life in a nursing home in San Francisco, and it was a very, very good one. But they didn't have enough staff, and he was totally blind in one eye and almost blind in the other. And they couldn't get it right that he did not like ice water. And he also was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when he was 94. He passed away when he was 95. But it took a lot of advocacy on my part to get them to understand what he needed. And they just didn't get it. They didn't get it. However, even though he might not remember what he did 10 minutes ago, he remembered what he did 2 weeks before in great detail. But one morning when I went to pick him up, I rode with him on the van to the lighthouse, and he was very upset. And I said, "What happened?" He said, "The nurse doused me with cold water because I didn't move fast enough." And I thought, wow, because I'd had hip surgery and they took me into the shower on one of those benches or whatever with the hole in the bottom. Anyway, and I was surprised that they had him standing in the shower. But at any rate, so he was very upset. And when I went back with him that afternoon, I talked to the head nurse, and she didn't give me how does he remember? He doesn't remember. I said to her, you got to get rid of that nurse. And they did. She never came back, and they put a mark against her record because they would not tolerate unkindness toward the staff. Although it took them a long time to learn how to deal with somebody who was blind. And Joni on Old Time Radio, she had a hell of a time where she was, and it forced her to move to Arizona, and she's living near her sister now. So a lot has to be done. It really does. And how to educate the people, you know, that should be, I think, part of the classes when they're learning to be nurses or they're learning to be caretakers, that they need to know how to deal with people with vision loss, because otherwise they just don't seem to get it. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Nikki. Great comments. Okay. So Galela Selassie is our second speaker. I hope I've come close on your name. I've butchered names before, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, it's Galela. Yeah, you said it beautifully. I did see there was another person with their hand up from a phone.
That's okay. Let's why don't you go ahead and we'll wait the rest of the questions and comments for the end, because time does get away from us. So
sure.
So thank you.
I'll be brief because Nancy did an amazing job highlighting a lot of the things. As I mentioned, I'm Galela Selassie, senior staff attorney at Justice and Aging. I'm based in DC, and the bulk of my work is federal policy focused. So I'm afraid I don't have a lot of California specific information for you. But I do, as Jeff mentioned, we are based out of California. We do have a lot of advocates who do work in California. So any questions you may have that I'm not able to answer, or if you want any state specific materials, I'm more than happy to send those your way or to give you other contact information. Justice and Aging has been around since 1972. We are primarily focused on older adults and people with disabilities, and we have a particular focus on achieving advancing equity for older adults and people with disabilities, including women, people of color, LGBTQ plus individuals, immigrants, and people with limited English proficiency. So again, Nancy did such an incredible job. I'm not going to go into too much detail. I would like to provide just a quick overview about Medicaid's role in nursing home care, just because it is such an important tool. And it's also sort of like the legal, sort of the legal avenue in which we're able to like reinforce and get a lot of enforcement done on the ground.
And in fact, Galela, just so that you know, is at the outset of your remarks, it is exactly Medicaid money that we are trying to target for in the bill that we have. So it's good that you bring that up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely useful in a lot of ways and for enforcement purposes as well. And then I'll dive into a little bit about some of the ways that the nursing home reform law has impacted residents and is intended to protect residents, and facilities don't always follow it as well as they should. And then I know this is very workforce centered, so I'll dive into a little bit of some of the findings we have on existing workforce studies. So folks may already know, I just think a good background is really useful. Many people think, wait a minute, for Medicare is sort of the like trademark health insurance program for older adults. What is its role in nursing home care? And when I was a legal aid attorney, many older people were really shocked to find out that Medicare is not covering long-term care. Only covers the first 100 days after a 3-day hospitalization. And that 3-day hospitalization is a little bit tricky. There's been some litigation around people who are admitted to the hospital on a observational status, which impacts whether or not that qualifies for the 100-day coverage of the nursing facility. And then that 3-day hospitalization was also waived during the public health emergency when the administration issued a bunch of waivers to make it easier for people to get coverage. And so because Medicare is so limiting, Medicaid steps in to cover the bulk of nursing home care in this country. I think at last estimate, I saw about 6 out of every 10 nursing home residents in the U.S. receive nursing home care at the current moment. So really, really huge. And then again, because Medicaid is geared more towards limited asset, low-income individuals, they have to spend down their assets, although it doesn't sound like that's the case with California's elimination of the asset test, which is great. And then they have to direct a significant amount of their money towards their personal, to their share of costs for the facility, usually leaving as little as like $30, $35 for their own care. Which can be problematic because sometimes facilities will say, well, wait, why don't you you know, pay out of pocket if you need an accommodation of some sort, if you need some sort of equipment to help you communicate, or if you need a private duty aid to help you 24 hours a day. One, that's not appropriate because the facility should be providing that. And then two, there is no money for these residents to provide that. So it's very problematic. And then if a nursing home resident is married and they have a spouse who doesn't live in the facility, there are spousal impoverishment protections so that they don't have to spend out all these assets or all this income or direct that to the facility. The community spouse does get to withhold a good chunk of that so that they're not impoverished. And so moving on to the nursing home reform law that was passed in 1987, it gave a lot of extra protections to residents for facilities that accept either Medicaid or Medicare. So there's a much smaller number of facilities that accept Medicaid, but a huge, huge, huge chunk of facilities do accept Medicare. So that's sort of the other conduit that through the Medicare program that CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, the federal agency that sort of runs all this, is able to provide some enforcement mechanisms. And one of the, you know, really keystone parts of the law is that it limited evictions to only six permissible situations. The first is if the resident failed to pay. Second, the resident no longer needs nursing facility care. Third, the resident's needs cannot be met in a nursing facility. Fourth is that the resident's presence in the facility endangers other safety. Fifth is that the resident's presence endangers others' health. And sixth is the nursing facility is going out of business. And then prior to eviction, facilities do have to give 30-day advance written notice in an accessible manner to the resident and their representatives. So if they have a guardian, if they have a spouse, an adult child who's helping them, they have to get a copy of the notice as well. That contains the reason for the eviction, the date of the eviction, location where the resident will be evicted to, appeal rights, and then the local nursing home ombudsman's contact information. In some instances, like if there's an endangerment to the other's eviction reason, then they may not have to provide the 30-day notice. One big key thing here is I noticed that I said advance written notice. Accessibility is the key factor in all of this. So it's not enough, especially if the resident has a visual impairment, to say, oh, look, I typed this up and now they have notice, because obviously that's not accessible to the individual, right? So that may require, even though the law itself doesn't say that there has to be additional notices, if that written notice is not acceptable, then the facility needs to either provide like a digital copy through a screen reader, provide a braille copy, something permanent that the resident has access to review that notice. And then there are instances where the facility sort of claims to be evicting for one of these permissible reasons, but it's actually sort of pretextual. So I'm going to just touch on a couple. One big one that's really common is that the facility can't meet the resident's needs. And this often occurs when the facility says, oh, this resident has high needs or needs specialized care, quote unquote. And then this also can often occur when the resident's needs some sort of accommodation for a disability, whether that's a nurse aide that's trained in handling that disability or a type of equipment to provide accessibility. And the facility says, oh, we can't do it, or they refuse to do it. As I mentioned earlier, nursing facilities have to provide a skilled nursing level of care, which is really high. Like was said earlier, the only thing higher than that is hospitalization, which is, for acute care, right? Not intended for long-term care. So effectively, you can't go any higher than a nursing facility level of care for long-term care. And so to be in operation, the facility just inherently has to have all the resources, the training, the equipment, the materials to meet that level of care, because you can't be called a skilled nursing facility and not have everything you need to provide a skilled nursing level of care. So sometimes those excuses of we can't meet their needs is actually pretty pretty lackluster, right? It usually doesn't really hold a lot of weight behind it once you really question what is the nursing home's excuse. And then upon admission, the resident's admission to the facility, they have to complete a personal care plan. with the resident's representative, and then signed off by the medical supervisor, which really specifies what are the unique care needs of this individual, accounting for any underlying conditions, accounting for what they need, what they want, if they're trying to not stay in the facility long-term, steps for transitioning out. And so in that case, when the facility says, oh, we can't meet their needs, the trick isn't to necessarily kick them out. The idea is, okay, we'll go back to that care plan and adjust it and make the necessary steps within the facility with the staffing and everything else to make sure that you are meeting those needs. And then a big one too, is that especially when a facility tries to use the excuse that, oh, we don't have this equipment, this accessibility equipment for the resident. Well, facilities are still subject to the ADA, the American Disabilities Act, and other disability protections and civil rights laws as well. So that's also not an excuse because they're obligated to have those basic legal accommodations met. And they can't skirt those legal requirements by evicting the residents. And then another big one is that the resident's presence in the facility endangers others. This could be if the resident is difficult or not following the rules. So, for example, they're making a lot of loud noises after, quiet hours or something to that effect. They may be wandering around when, it's quote unquote bedtime or whatever rules the facility has. And so this behavior may be disruptive, but disruptive doesn't mean dangerous, right? And then another instance that's a little bit more tricky is if the resident might be hitting staff or might be hitting other residents. And obviously violence is not tolerated, should not be allowed. But in this situation, context is really important. So earlier there's an example somebody who didn't like cold water and the facility couldn't understand that. And sometimes this occurs in a situation here too. So an example I'll give that we've actually heard from a state ombudsman advocate was that an 80-year-old woman who weighed 110 pounds, so very petite, living in a facility because of a recent stroke and had some muscle loss as well as vision loss. And then they also have diabetes and recently diagnosed with dementia. A new male nurse comes in and says they have to administer the resident's insulin on her belly. That's the best place for it to be absorbed properly. And so he comes in, he tries to expose her abdomen, tries to pull up her shirt. The resident refuses, tries to push him away. He comes back and says, hey, you have to take your medicine. So then she just starts hitting him and kicking him. And then the facility says, hey, she's a danger to our staff. We have to evict her. Again, violence is not okay. Hitting is not okay. But context is really important here. She's has this visual impairment, so she may not be able to see exactly what's happening. She just knows that there's a needle coming at her, right? Or not knowing exactly what medication can be given. She has dementia, so she may not know what her conditions are or who this person is, especially if they're new, especially if they're a man and she's a woman. That could create another level of uncertainty and fear. And then she honestly might not even know exactly where she is, right? Especially if it's in a new dementia diagnosis, it often takes a little bit of time to figure out what stage then they might be in and how to sort of address their needs once they have this new diagnosis. And then again, because of her physical stature and her underlying conditions, the question is how much damage did she cause the individual, right? So a petite woman who suffered from a stroke may not be in the position where they're going to cause a lot of injury or a lot of harm, again, even though it's not tolerated. So in this case, the question isn't necessarily should that be evicted, but in what ways can their care plan be adjusted to meet their needs? So, for example, maybe she has dementia where she's a sundowner. So later in the evening, she's has less lucidity and is more confused. Maybe she needs a female nurse to accompany the male nurse for a while to calm her down so she gets more familiar. We've heard of situations where individuals were given on prescription bottles bright neon colored labels so that they know this bright green neon label is for this and this bright pink neon label is for this. So that, again, helps them both with their visual awareness and then just with their mental understanding of what medication is for what. And so those are things that might be more appropriate than an eviction in those cases. And then lastly, I'll just quickly touch on the nursing facility workforce. This is a really hot topic at the federal level. It obviously sounds like so at the state level. The federal agency, CMS, is working on a study on revamping the workforce staffing requirements for nursing homes that should be out within the next couple months. And when we talk about a sufficient workforce, we're talking about the number of staff, so number of aides, nurses per resident. But then competency is a huge part of that. It's not helpful to have dozens and dozens of nurses and aides if they don't know how to provide the care that they need to. And that was another comment that was made earlier. We've also been seeing that their staffing level and competent staffing, is a huge indicator for residents' health outcomes. And so by improving nursing home staffing levels and nursing home staffing competency, some of the outcomes that are improved include like significantly reduced incontinence, reduced UTIs, catheterizations, better treatment of pain, reduced incidences of ulcers, falls, weight loss or dehydration, reduced rehospitalizations or referrals to the emergency department, better infection control and prevention, especially given the pandemic, that's huge. And then fewer incidents of missed care, missed dosages of medications, things of that, and fewer mortality rates. And so in terms of staffing levels, and this applies to just total staffing, a huge study, really important study from 2001, found that at a minimum, each resident needs 0.75 hours of RN care per day, 0.55 hours of LPN care per day, and 2.8 hours of CNA care per day. So a total of 4.1 hours per resident per day of care across all these levels of staff. And that's just the bare minimum. And that's a study from over 20 years ago, right? So many people argue that even that might not be sufficient. And like about half of the states require even less than that or have less than that. So it's really concerning that even this bare minimum threshold that might actually not even be the most accurate threshold isn't being met. And that's one of the things that the feds are considering mandating and or improving on. And then lastly, just in terms of training, it's not just good for the resident, right? That long list of the great outcomes that residents can get when they're properly trained. It's also good for the workers throughout, especially in the early days of COVID. There was all this talk about our heroes and how wonderful nursing homes and healthcare workers are. And that we don't really treat them that way when one, their wages are terrible and they're not given proper protection for infection control measures and things like that. And then two, when they're not trained well. And there've been studies that say that especially CNAs, nurse aides, who are usually the lowest paid of direct care workers, they're much happier with their jobs and they're much more likely to stay in the field when they're given proper training. Because one, they're good at it, right? And then two, it also can lead to career advancement and opportunities for higher pay. And so in terms of nurse aide training hours, current federal standards only require 75 hours of training, and that's in the facility experience, academic experience in the lecture halls, and then also lab experience as well. So all that totals 75 hours. Again, the bare minimum based on staffing, based on studies, says that at least 120 hours needs to be provided for nurse aides. And that the training should be covered by the facilities. Oftentimes, the workers themselves have to pay for the training, which is a huge obstacle. And so that's all I have. I'm more than happy to send additional resources to folks, but I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Galayla. So we now have time for questions. Larry, are you our host with the most out there? Well,
I don't know about the most, but I guess I am the host.
Okay, do we have any raised hands?
Not so far. Not so far.
Okay, I know we did have one. I guess they...
I lie. Ending 844.
There's got to be Steve or Judy.
Yep.
Hi.
Go ahead, Steve. You're on.
Yes, Steve Mendelson here. Can you hear me?
We can.
Great. Thank you for the presentation. I think that lying behind the shortage of training and resources for the administration of nursing homes in a way that is appropriate for blind and low vision people is, of course, a lack of money. It's equally true on the other end that the lack of resources that might help to prevent these people from having to enter nursing homes prematurely is also a lack of money. I wonder, though, has anybody ever done any studies in terms of the return on investment, so to speak, of expenditures made in either of these two areas, either the upgrading of the quality of life for low vision and blind people in nursing homes, or the area of services and programs that would help to delay or prevent admission to the nursing homes in the first place?
Well, that's probably a Nancy question.
The only studies that I'm aware of, but I don't read all of the literature. There's been
Could you start there?
Yeah, I'll do it.
There's been some very good studies on the return on investment if somebody is receiving skilled nursing type care but remains in their own home. There are many programs now that are called Nursing Home Without Walls, or special funding opportunities to bring the skilled nursing capabilities into the home. And what they find is whether the services are provided in the person's home or in the institution, they're pretty much on par, just as expensive. However, people are much happier and feel they have a better quality of life when the service is provided in a familiar environment like the home. There have been some studies of the visually impaired nursing home population, but I do not know of one that looks at the rate of return of training. I do know that there's been some studies about falls prevention, that if you provide both the staff and the blind resident with appropriate mobility training and risk management that does not require them to be put in a wheelchair unless they need it for other reasons, that with that training, there's a huge reduction in falls. But you're asking a great question, and the information may exist. I'm just not familiar with it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. As a former New Yorker, I've long been an admirer of Vision's work.
Well, thank you.
Call-in user one is next, and you are currently muted, so go ahead and unmute.
Hello. This happened a while ago. I had a friend. She went to assisting living in Corona. She was there. She paid for her own things via her money. She always asked for enlarged prints and being visualized, and they never gave it to her. Then she went to a private nursing facility as a hospice, and this lady wouldn't even give her for with the TV, let alone anything for her, and just let her lay in the bed.
Sounds like that's a situation that requires the intervention of an ombudsperson or actual reporting to the agency that's responsible for overseeing nursing homes. Usually it's the Department of Health, but it's called different things in different states. That is a form of abuse. To withhold services and devices and information that would enable that person to be able to be as independent as possible. It may very well be a violation of the ADA, but it certainly should be reported to the authorities.
Well, she's now no longer here, but I didn't know who to talk to or who to get a hold of. to help her out, because her family wasn't even helping her out back then.
Yeah, in California, they have, and every state has, I believe, and Galila could answer this question, but in California, they have an Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and they have folks located throughout the state, and if you call that office, they will go out and investigate complaints. And that's the best entity I know to look into complaints like that.
Well, now I know what to do if I have any issues in the future. But thank you. That's why I was on this call trying to figure out what it could do in the future. Thank you very much for it. It's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, and I just...
Resources, the Area Agency on Aging, the AAA, if they don't have the responsibility, some AAAs are the ombudsman. They have the ombudsman program themselves, but if they are not, they will absolutely know how to report, who to report to. It's usually a hotline. But I will leave the legal advisor to answer it on a more national basis.
No, everything Nancy and Jeff said is totally right. I think the one other thing I would add is sometimes there are a little bit of jurisdictional issues, whether nursing homes can have authority to like go out to a private assisted living, for example, I'm not sure about, or if there's like a home care situation, then that might be some challenges. But every state is required to have a protection and advocacy agency that was part of the ADA. And they are a disability focused group that ensures compliance with the ADA across all states. And they have a lot of power to investigate, to report, and to provide advocacy. They're usually like Disability Rights California or Disability Rights North Carolina or something. But that's a huge resource as well.
Absolutely.
Jeff, we are at 57. Do you want to do one more?
One more, yeah. Let's do one more.
So, Regina, you can unmute, please.
Hello. Thank you for this wonderful presentation. I just have a comment and a quick question. The comment is that oftentimes when you're blind or visually impaired, we're finding that it almost is the opposite with the evictions. They deem the person, even if they are independent and have been living independently and maybe went, you know, because they had some other condition and it's resolved, that the blindness makes them unable to live independently, and the nursing home holds on to them because of the lack of awareness that a person without vision can actually be independent. And related to that is, in our chapter, we have several people that have gone to nursing homes and they will not let them move around. They just want them to lay in bed. They don't even want them to move to a chair in their room or go to the lavatory. And there's just a lack of awareness that a blind person can navigate their space safely. And it's counterproductive because, especially for people that go in for a condition where they need to move, just the physical therapy that they receive is not enough to help them get strong enough to leave.
So, hey, thank you, Regina. All right. I want to really thank my two speakers, Nancy B. Miller and Galila Selassie, for their remarks today. I hope you've enjoyed them as much as I have. And with that, I think we're ready to go on to the second part of today's CAAVL convention session.
Great. Thank you all so much. Feel free to reach out if you have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.